upon which the church adopts public policy issues.
And that's Labor and Economic Development Committee as a subcommittee today until we see if anyone else is interested enough to show up.
The Catholic Conference here on a whole round of
issues. There's one. We will start with a public hearing on House Bill 2009, open public hearing.
We have discussed this bill with Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese. They were not prepared to testify today because they had some concerns and was
Mr. Chairman, simply raises the prize that can be awarded in bingo or lottery games, and it also allows them to operate two games a year with a $10,000 prize.
Related to the potential,
and it also allows the Department of Justice on an emergency basis to allow a person to manage or operate more than one licensed game.
Parents. And one provision of the Minnesota law, which I would call
doesn't allow that, but there are circumstances where, on an emergency basis,
amendments.
It would appear to be warranted
in the Section 1, Subdivision 1, Subsection E.
John, you signed up in 2009.
The sentence that reads, the hospital may not inquire into the identity of the mother of the person leaving the newborn or call the police, provided the newborn is unharmed when presented to the hospital. The hospital may ask the mother or the person leaving the newborn about the medical history of the mother or newborn, but the mother or the person leaving the newborn is not required to provide any information. The hospital may provide the mother or the person leaving the newborn.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Helen, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Charitable Gaming Association.
The
OCGA is an association of not-for-profit organizations who are licensed to conduct bingo, raffle, and Monte Carlo games under the Oregon Charitable Activities Law. And the OCGA is in support of 2009 and respectfully request your aye vote. We've worked very closely with the Department of Justice on this bill. They have signed off on all of the contents of the bill, and Kirk Harvey is here from the DOJ Charitable Activities Division. If you have any questions for him, he is here for your questions as well. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are currently 287 bingo licensees in Oregon. They include 56 Class A licensees, which are your largest, and then 56 Class B, 129 Class C, and then 46 Class D licensees all across our state. The not-for-profit organizations that operate bingo games in Oregon need House Bill 2009. Faced with stiff competition from tribal casinos and bingo games in Washington State that offer unlimited prize payouts, Oregon's not-for-profit bingo licensees are struggling to stay afloat. House Bill 2009 begins to level the playing field and allows Oregon's not-for-profits to remain viable, and Oregon definitely needs its not-for-profits. I've listed for you there on the handout in my testimony a sampling of some of the organizations that will benefit from House Bill 2009. You have everything from 19 BFW chapters to 30 Elks Lodges to the Mill City Volunteer Fire Department to the Oregon State Fair and Expo Center and the Eugene Kwan Foundation, just to name a few. The above organizations represent only a small number of not-for-profits that operate here in Oregon, and you can help them survive and continue to provide the vital services and assistance that they provide to hundreds of thousands of Oregonians. And thank you for your time and attention, and I can answer any questions you may have.
199, which would provide places where newborns could be safely surrendered without fear of repercussions.
Yes, my name is Greg Hitchcock, Chair of IRN Committee, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Sports Trust, which is comprised of about a dozen amateur sports organizations. Most of those organizations conduct bingo games as a fundraiser. I'm also on the Board of Directors of an organization that conducts fundraisers. Some typical people might miss the benefits of bingo. For example, this morning in the Oregonian, the front page sports section is about a girl from Beaverton. She's a fencer. She's one of the best in the world. She wouldn't be on this without bingo money. Her coach is subsidized with bingo money. He's a world-class coach. Her training facilities subsidized with bingo fundraising. It's one of the best facilities in the country. And she has to go to competitions all over the world, which is very expensive, and that is subsidized in part by bingo dollars. So that's a story that's today, that's bingo, and they don't mention bingo in the story, but that's behind the scenes for a lot of organizations making things possible, like the Springfield High School track that we've helped build, or the Tualatin Hills Dryland Training Center, which makes that facility in Beaverton one of the best diving facilities for athletes in the United States, and people come from all over the world, Japan. Athletes have been there recently training at that facility. The Lewis and Clark College Track is the only place in Portland where they've had world-class track competitions, where Portlanders can see Olympic team members come and compete in our city. Volleyball all over the state. Kids learning bike racing at the Alpenrose Velodrome. These are all areas where Bingo Money's touched. Just a sampling of things I've been involved with, and we could trot numerous people up here to tell you how Bingo Money's benefited them, but I'll let that stand, and unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Potentially avert cases like this if there was a case where without any fear of repercussions, a woman could simply go and surrender that child. Senate Bill 199 does provide such a safe haven. Senate Bill 199 also
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kirk Harvey. I'm the chief investigator with the Oregon Department of Justice Charitable Activities Section. My office oversees the registration licensing program for regulating gaming activity in the state of Oregon. Our office is not in opposition of this bill. We have had an opportunity to review the A and Gross version of House Bill 2009. We do not object to it. The most important points are that it is true that charitable organizations are having a more difficult time than at any point in the past in competing in the charitable gaming market. As an example, in 1994, the annual bingo handle collectively was $86 million in the state of Oregon, and in 2000 it has dropped to $66 million. Therefore, our office is not in opposition of House Bill 2009 in its amended form.
Ask this question, but
and I'm available for questions.
Maybe you know from previous programs we've had, but is this the sort of thing where you might be able to get public service?
This only applies to charitable organizations.
Yes, sir. Nonprofit organizations.
Nonprofit
organizations, those that are tax exempt under the Federal Internal Revenue Service Code. So that would extend beyond charitable organizations to things like fraternal organizations, like Elks, Eagles, things like that, associations, school districts, things like that.
How often do these organizations have to keep their books for the Department of Justice? I mean, do they have to show you their purchase time? Because you know the handle, they must, you must know in pretty good detail what how they're paying staff, for instance.
That's correct. The largest licensees, Class A licensees, that would be most impacted by this would be, by this bill, are required to file annual or correction. They're required to file quarterly reports with our office and include a lot of information regarding expenses, prize payouts, and that sort of thing. And they're also subject to periodic review by our gaming inspectors.
Mr. Chair, and do you have any indication that there are nonprofits who pay their executive directors or members of their staff?
Let me leave you the thought that I'd like you to take back to the group as a
high salary.
If you hand this kid to a warm
body, I guess I'm looking at the question of, you know, there's this issue of some of these charitable nonprofits are actually people who are involved in them do quite well.
Our office, the Attorney General, has general oversight responsibility for all charitable organizations that hold, those organizations that hold assets or solicit funds in the state of Oregon. And yes, it's correct, there are some organizations which are under the office's scrutiny for executive director compensation issues, but there are none. There are no gaming licensees that are under the scrutiny of the Department of Justice for those types of issues.
I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 199. This legislation is
similar to Safe Haven
or abandoned.
I wanted to be clear about what you just said. So you're saying that within this venue, you don't have concerns, but within the broader venue, you do?
Yes, we have about 19,000 charitable organizations that are registered with our office that we track and review. And of that, only a small percentage of them hold gaming licenses, and we do not have any open investigations or any issues before our office that raise these sorts of concerns.
All of these laws aim to protect the lives of children by providing the parents of infants with identified and safe places to birth them, as opposed to abandoning them in random locations such as dumpsters or motel rooms.
Ms. Corcoran?
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services conducted an informal newspaper articles on the subject and found that in 105 infants
were abandoned in public places.
33 of those infants were found dead. Now, that is not an exhaustive list, but that's what they found from newspaper research.
In Oregon, cases of abandoned infants
are infrequent.
Well, the only discussion, Mr. Chair, is the discussion I heard about those butterfly ballots in Florida, and they figured that those people had to be crazy not to be able to figure those out because they could keep 15 bingo cards going at a time.
Objection to the motion.
My grandmother was a victim of bingo all her life at the Catholic Church in Youngstown, Ohio. It's a horrible, horrible thing to have happen on Thursday nights, but, you know, at least she wasn't playing video poker. Of course, they didn't have video poker then. But otherwise, I guess we better proceed.
No objection.
Senator Barkley.
I would rather spare the floor of that.
I'm already dressing up like Moses tomorrow. What else do you want?
Senator Decker cares, though.
We have offered to Senator Courtney some proposed amendments.
Okay. Public hearing on 2572.
Consistent with existing child protection statutes. We don't believe that the amendment changed the spirit nor the intended outcome of Senate Bill 199. And while our support of the bill is not contingent upon the committee's verbatim adoption of the amendment,
current law requires
telecommunications
utilities that get more than 75% of their income
to take a look at the
in Oregon
revised bill, and it does look as though most of the amendments have been incorporated into the bill as it now appears.
If a telecommunications utility gets less than half of its revenue,
the development, use, and
gross revenue from sources in Oregon,
in other states,
this bill would
and what
no longer require that the Public Utilities Commission authorize them to issue stock or bonds or other securities.
Here,
right now, that number
copy.
Is at 75%.
This goes to Vice Chair Courtney or you, Chair Minnis. It is a compilation of the development of all those laws in other states and some summaries of them. I won't recite the findings here, but I do want you to have that.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. I'm Shelley Jensen, Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon. Currently, telecommunications companies must receive approval from the public utilities prior to issuing stock, debt, and certain other financial instruments. The only exception is telecommunications utilities that derive three-quarters of their gross revenues from outside the state of Oregon. This bill would change that to one-half of gross revenues from outside the state of Oregon. The PUC would still be able to review these transactions after the fact as part of a rate case. And if telecommunications utilities did not use prudence or if they used the money for purposes other than those specified in the statute, the PUC could come back and require that the utility go back into the mode. There isn't any opposition to this. We actually worked with the PUC to develop this language. A couple reasons that Verizon would like to see the standard go to one half is that would get us out of pre-approval, and the company that would be borrowing from Verizon is Verizon of the Northwest, which is made up of Oregon, Idaho, and Washington, and Oregon is the only state that requires pre-approval. So it kind of causes some problems internally for us. In addition, in some states where we have been required to get pre-approval, we've missed out on getting the best interest rate. It's sort of like buying a house, but if you're not ready, when the interest rate changes, you miss it. And so this way we would be able to be a little bit more flexible in getting better rates, which would benefit both our shareholders and our ratepayers. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Burdick, I don't think I can answer that question, question. Right now.
Not about the bill, though. It's about Verizon. What cable companies?
What was the question?
The question is if you're a parent and you want to turn the baby in,
we're a telephone company.
can't or won't go yourself, and you have somebody else do it.
Isn't there subsidiaries that own cable?
What would be the status of that person?
I think that's an important question. It's one of the issues that I raised with Senator Cordy in terms of getting this bill to the public hearing. And part of the reason I mentioned the NBT model, I think we have some fairly substantial
what's the relationship between AT&T and Verizon?
Make sure that
competitor.
When we have a circumstance that
answers that
Verizon is too
we're not going to get very good at it. Trying to make you look good here.
I don't
to did you guys run a bingo outfit out of Verizon?
Right. Yeah, at our Beaverton office.
Senator Gorsuch.
Right. Do we have some information from regarding their neutrality on the bill?
No prosecution.
We have no one signed up to the PUC
between those two elements.
Someone is here. Mark Hellman of the Public Utility Commission. And we are, can't recall either neutral or support this bill.
That's that coordination piece that I think we're going to have to spend a little time on.
I know that we're not opposed. This was taken up a month or two ago in our legislative meeting, and I know I was supportive of it.
That'll do. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Senator Corbin,
thank you very much.
So what would be the downside, just playing devil's advocate for a minute, of doing a PC campaign?
I guess a follow-up to Senator Burdick's question, and I don't know, it's probably the
chair, Senator Corbin. The downside
gives me an infant.
Would be that the company would go and issue bonds that might not be the lowest interest rate possible, and in which case, in a rate case, which is what we do.
Senator Byers, right, given
in a rate case, we would look at it and argue over whether the cost of debt is what's recorded, or maybe they should have exchanged for some lower debts. And it's harder to do it after the fact than the pre-approval, which is what we do now. They come in and they ask for agreement on spreads, and we review it, and then go before the Public Utility Commission. And while that is not taken as rate approval, the commission does have a chance to review those rates before they actually get issued.
Mr. Chairman,
I think that might be the one harm I can think of.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any other questions?
As you may know, Planned Parenthood has 8 health care clinics throughout the state, and we have been providing the women of Oregon and their families with services and information on reproductive health care for more than 30 years. Senate Bill 199 seeks to address a serious and seemingly growing problem of newborn abandonment, and we support the bill to name treatment of women who find themselves in this crisis situation. And while we are glad to see the focus of the bill is not about punishing women, this bill does point to a much bigger issue, which is preventing unintended pregnancy and the need for broad public access to family planning services. This session you will also see a number of bills addressing the root causes of the problem Senate Bill 199 seeks to resolve. The name of this Senate Bill 421 requiring prescription equity for birth control, House Bill 3284 providing for urgent access to emergency contraception, House Bill 2309 and 10 increasing access to perinatal services, and House Bill 2885 increasing access to services for victims of domestic violence. Planned Parenthood has long advocated a broad-based approach, and we see Senate Bill 199 as just
notably
one piece of the solution.
$100,000
we need to provide more support in the form of education and services so that young women won't find themselves in these desperate situations in the first place.
The amount of their assets
they
can
one
have
concern,
in a
and
stock
I'm not
corporation
sure it's possible
providing
to address
accounting
in the bill,
services
but as
to
some
the
of the previous speakers stated,
and
some
it
of these
removes
women
from,
are giving birth in
the regulator,
and
PCBS,
therefore they're not getting proper
minimum insurance
and surety
coverage that they have to have.
And I don't know whether we could include some
bill,
way to create a referral for them at the time
margin,
that the baby surrenders, or some way to try and address that aspect that they themselves may be in need of
my
some medical attention as well.
Should be
again,
eight,
Planned Parenthood appreciates
which
the efforts of Senate Bill 199, but we must do more work up front in the form of preventing
person to help young women make responsible choices and thus prevent unintended pregnancy. Preventing unintended pregnancy is the way to avoid the need for SB-199 in the first place. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Pam Levitt and Sal Scoggins, representing credit unions.
Representative Wharton.
Hopefully we can find Pam, because she was here and she left. And
forgive
she
me
went downstairs to make some copies real quick. She should be back momentarily. I
well, you better pitch it quick.
Mr. Chairman, I can stall for about 15 seconds. Tim Martinez for the bankers plan to not
Mr.
be here
Chairman,
today.
This committee may have
to tell you
representative
that they support
from
these amendments.
Which has been called valid. And I appreciate
now,
that.
I wonder where Tim might be right
now. This bill this morning.
I
would like to
send
my support and express my support for Senate Bill 199 and give a perspective of women with 4.5-year-olds and 6-year-olds.
I can at least offer some enlightenment as to whereabouts of Mr. Martinez. He is at a reception. I think he may actually be planning on coming back at a reception for Mr. Knuckleby, who is retiring.
I guess personal.
He had his reception starting at 3 o'clock.
Mr. Knuckleby a golfer?
As I was working in...
You know, I don't know.
Have you heard of Knuckleby golf in...
And working for the commanding general, and
nice
still
try.
Had to deal with a lot of the.
We're getting rid of the. Let's get rid of the young kids.
Tragic.
Yeah, the upset. That's an embarrassment today.
We must take your name to the records, being officially, and then you keep stammering, and as we're waiting for Ms. Levitt, if she ever shows up, very happy.
Gave birth, and.
I will. My name is Harold Scoggins, and I'm with Farley, Wada & Witt. We're the outside counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. And I will defer further comment until Ms. Levitt.
Good afternoon. Make it.
Tell me the name of your company again.
The fact that this is only one component of a
Farley, Wada & Witt. We're attorneys, and we're the outside counsel.
Wada & Witt. I really like that. I really like
that.
We knew that would be the case, and that's why we did it.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon, catching my breath.
And unfortunately, it is
House Bill 2775 is a bill that we have been working on for over a year. It is something that we do each year. We ask our Oregon Credit Unions to review the Oregon Credit Union Act for any technical changes or amendments that they would like us to make during the legislative session. House Bill 2775 is a result of those discussions, as well as discussions with our regulator at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The bill passed 50-0 on the House side, and we will be reviewing an amendment from the Oregon Bankers Association today, which we have accepted. I've spoken with each of you over the course of the last few months, and we have had several negotiations with the Oregon bankers on this bill, and happy to report to each of you that we've worked out an agreement and that the bill is to both our satisfaction with this amendment that they will be introducing.
So
the main change in House Bill 2775 is the change in the member business lending cap. In 1998, Congress passed the Credit Union Membership Access Act, and this act placed several restrictions on member business loans that credit unions can make. Currently in the Oregon Credit Union Act, there is a $100,000 cap. That is the main issue in the bill. The rest of it is all considered technical changes. Hal will go through a brief section by section for you to explain the rest of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Corbin,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I'm the district attorney in Astoria.
Ms. Levitt has provided you with my written testimony, and I'll just give you a brief summary of the various changes that are contained in the bill. It makes about five what I would call technical changes and one the member business loan change. Ms. Levitt's already referred to. The first change actually is made at the request of and in consultation with the regulator. They have asked, and we believe that it's appropriate, to delete a current provision in the statute, which is RS 723.122, that requires the regulator to issue rules setting the amount of insurance that a credit union must carry. Instead, deleting this provision will leave that issue to the regulator's discretion based on safety and soundness and what the regulator believes is appropriate business practices. As a practical matter, they already do this anyway without need of actually going through a rulemaking process, and they can be more flexible without it. The second change updates some outdated language in RS 723.152, and it permits credit unions to offer certain products and financial services. Right now, that regulation is very specific and designates specific products and services that credit unions are able to offer in addition to share accounts and loans. And as technology changes, as the financial marketplace changes, credit unions and other financial service providers are constantly innovating, coming up with new ways to meet the needs of members, new delivery methods. And so we've asked to make this section a little more broad and simply allow us to offer products and services that are consistent with our mission as a credit union as set forth in ORS 723.006. This particular provision is the subject of the amendment that is the Dash 2 amendment referred to earlier, and the association has agreed with substituting the wording of that amendment for the existing wording that's in the bill. The third change does two things to ORS 723.152 subsection 20. It deletes the requirement to obtain regulator approval to hire accountants. We think it's part and parcel of the business of a credit union to have to hire accountants. We have to provide reports to shareholders and reports to the regulators and insurers already, and there's no need to have specific regulatory approval to have to hire accountants. It's just what we have to do. This also deletes a provision that authorizes credit unions to invest in a service corporation. That authority is already contained elsewhere in the statute, as well as the limitations on that authority, and this is simply a cleanup matter to eliminate a duplicate provision. Fourth, there's a glitch in the current statute that relates to payment of dividends or interest when an account is closed. Under the current statute, there's a specific way that the credit union is required to compute dividends, and that method does not always accurately reflect the way things happen in practice. This change will permit credit unions to pay accrued dividends when an account is closed at the rate that's currently in effect, as opposed to at the rate that was last declared by the board of directors of the credit union. In other words, if you walk in and close your account today and the current rate is 3.5% on accounts, and that was just up from last month's rate of 3%, this will permit the credit union to pay at 3.5%, which is the current rate, instead of 3%, which is last month's rate, which is what the statute currently requires. And the last technical change is that this removes an outdated provision regarding dormant accounts that actually conflicts with the Federal Truth in Savings Law and the NCUA regulations that implement it. It takes out a provision that says that when an account becomes dormant, the credit union can simply move that money to a separate general ledger account that's not considered an account that's owned by the member and can quit paying dividends on that account. There's not a lot of credit unions, as far as I know of, that are actually doing that in practice, and as I said, I think that conflicts with the Federal Truth in Savings Act, and so we'd just like to take that out. There is existing law elsewhere in the Unclaimed Property Act that deals with what the credit union has to do when money in an account actually becomes abandoned for the purposes of that act. And there's no point in confusing that with accounts that are dormant for the purposes of whether the credit union can assess fees or not. And then last but not least, this eliminates the arbitrary $100,000 cap on loans that credit unions can make to what I call non-natural person members, a corporation, a partnership, an LLC, a limited partnership, anything that's not a living and breathing human being. The current Oregon statute says that for those types of borrowers, a credit union can loan money to them, but only up to $100,000. Anybody who's done much lending in the farming area, or even to a company that's a general contractor, a ma-and-pa general contracting business, will know that $100,000 doesn't buy you much equipment or even many pickup trucks to operate that business. This limitation has put Oregon State Charter Credit Unions at a disadvantage as opposed to federal credit unions, which are not subject to a $100,000 limit. And this change will leave Oregon State Charter Credit Unions subject to all of the other loan-to-one-borrower limitations that are in place. There are limitations as to how much the credit union can loan based on the credit union's net worth, based on the credit union's assets. And Oregon State credit unions will remain subject to all of the federal limitations that are applicable to business loans that credit unions can make to members. So what this really does is level the playing field between Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions and federal credit unions so that they can make loans that are to non-natural person members on the same terms and the same conditions. Under the federal loans that the federal rules that apply to member business loans, all of these loans have to be guaranteed by the principals of a business.
Along with us, or would they proceed with their plan?
And then last but not least, this eliminates the arbitrary $100,000 cap on loans that credit unions can make to what I call non-natural person members, a corporation, a partnership, an LLC, a limited partnership, anything that's not a living or breathing human being. The current Oregon statute says that for those types of borrowers, a credit union can loan money to them, but only up to $100,000. Anybody who's done much lending in the farming area, or even to a company that's a general contractor, a ma-and-pa general contracting business, will know that $100,000 doesn't buy you many much equipment or even many pickup trucks to operate that business. This limitation has put Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions at a disadvantage as opposed to federal credit unions, which are not subject to a $100,000 limit. And this change will leave Oregon State Chartered Credit Union subject to all of the other loan-to-one-borrower limitations that are in place. There are limitations as to how much the credit union can loan based on the credit union's net worth, based on the credit union's assets. And Oregon State Credit Unions will remain subject to all of the federal limitations that are applicable to business loans that credit unions can make to members. So what this really does is level the playing field between Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions and federal credit unions so that they can make loans that are to non-natural person members on the same terms and the same conditions. Under the federal loans that the federal rules that apply to member business loans, all of these loans have to be guaranteed by the principals of a business anyway. So we will continue to have personal liability for all of the business loans from the principals of the business. It's just that we'll actually be able to make a loan to the corporation itself or LLC or whatever that exceeds $100,000. And that's it. I'll be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay. Any questions?
Senator Corcoran, are you awake?
No, I've been really intriguing. Just thinking about bingo, you know.
Mr. Chair, I need to declare a potential conflict of interest in that I serve as a member of the Albina Community Bank Board, and also I am a member of Oregon Rails Federal Credit Union.
Thank you. Close public hearing. Open work session. House Bill 2775.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckard.
I would move House Bill 2775 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Deckard,
you know
I would like to have an amendment.
Oh.
Adopted.
That's good now.
That's K2 amendment.
Is that the banker's amendment?
Yes, it is.
Can I rescind that motion?
I have not accepted that motion, so you don't have to rescind it.
I'd move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckard moves the -A2 amendment into House Bill 2775. Any discussion on the motion? Objections?
The order is Senator Deckard.
I move House Bill 2775 to the floor with a, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Deckard moves House Bill 2775 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? For the record, Senator Gordley's conflict of interest will be noted in the work session along with the public hearing. Any objections to the motion? Ordered.
Sure.
Senator Atkinson wants to carry the bill.
Thank you.
Close work session. Okay. We need about a 30-second break, you said, so you can tell me what's going on with that other one. I wonder if here, there might be a word problem.
And the gas. There's just the list. And Joe Bill, I wanted this to read just medical, nothing else. Because in the current law, there's a single sentence in the House about HVAC, comma, manual, comma, boiler, comma, and goes on. Well, that wasn't in the amendment request that I sent down. When I heard about it, I called and said, I want line 19 to read only medical. Phone call. The amendment came back, it says medical equipment.
No, we haven't done it yet.
And she and Joe made, and I chatted with Lauren on the record that there was no intent whatsoever to change the meaning from current law to medical. And the word equipment is not to be viewed as any modifier to that word.
All right. Open work session, House Bill 2152.
Mr. Chairman, 2152 comes back to you with the Dash A5 amendments, which consolidate amendments that you had before. There were a couple of minor changes that fixed and clarified some language. There is one concern that has been brought up, and that is that on page 3 of the printed bill, on line 31, is the word vendor-specific medical equipment. The current language of the law lists a number of entities that are covered under limited energy technician, and that word, it just uses the word medical. It doesn't say medical equipment. When I heard about this request to have just medical on there, I phoned legislative counsel and asked them that line 31 have only the word medical on it. It came back and is in the Dash 5 as medical equipment. I believe that that is counsel's attempt to do what I said, but they left the word equipment on there. There was no intent with the amendment or with the original bill to have the word equipment modify medical in this sense. Mr. Brewer agrees with that interpretation, but I felt it important to put it on the record that that was certainly the intent of my request, and if the committee decides, that will be the intent of the committee with the amendment.
Okay. We have the Dash A5 amendments in front of us that we could modify and remove the word equipment.
Yes, we can, and then bring it back, right?
No.
No?
No. Committee can make committee amendments, too.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move then that on page... Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules
for
purposes of
conceptual amendment.
Committee amendment.
Committee amendment.
Conceptual committee amendment.
Senator Gorley moves for suspension of rules.
We need help. There's lots of it. Thank you.
Senator Gorley moves to suspend the rules for the purposes of amending the Dash 85 amendments. Any objections? The order. Senator Gorley?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that on page 3, line 31, the word...
We're amending the amendment to remove the word equipment on page 15.
On page...
on page 1, line 15 okay. of the A5 amendment.
So moved.
Okay. Senator Gorley moves that we add the word equipment to the A5 amendment on page 15, page 1, line 15, so that the line 15 would then delete vendor-specific and the word equipment. Is there any discussion of the motion? Any objections? The order. We now have an amended amendment. The order.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the A5 amendment as amended.
Thank you. Senator Gorley moves the Dash A5's amendment as amended by the committee to House Bill 2152. Is there any objections? The order.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bills 2152 A and Gross as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gorley moves House Bill 2152 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? So, any volunteers carry?
Okay.
Senator Corcoran will carry the bill. Close the work session. A work session on House Bill 2702. Mr. Poppins.
Yeah, the Dash 5.
A5 amendments, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, this bill was before the committee earlier with the Dash 4 amendments. At that time, the Department of Justice and the proponents of the bill requested amendments. Basically, the amendments do three things. It makes clear that the statement of costs are to be estimated costs. It makes it clear that the services that are contracted for were contracted for by the provider. And the Department of Justice has requested language that basically says that the agreements, if I can paraphrase what's actually happening, that they're good for just what they say, that there's no implication that outside matters change those agreements in any way, except and they make reference to what is called the parole provision, which says that there are in fact some circumstances where the conditions under which the agreement was made can be brought into account if you go to court. There seemed to be no objection to any of these amendments by any of the parties that were party to the part.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2702 and Gross.
Senator Gorley moves the Dash A5 amendments into House Bill 2702A. Is there any discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Gorley, move bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2702 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gorley, move House Bill 2702 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Objections? Done. Okay. Senator Gorley will carry the bill. Close the work session. Okay, where are we? Oh, yeah, 3207. Work session on 3207.
Mr. Chairman, the last time this bill was heard, Senator Harper wanted assurances that the bill did indeed allow facilities at allow the use of these bonds at facilities that were owned by a secular or religious institution. In response to that request, I contacted legislative counsel, talked to the attorney there that drafted the original bill. I also talked with Mr. Love, who is an attorney but does not practice law in this arena, but he told me that the lawyers for the bonding companies agree with that interpretation, and he opined that those are probably the most conservative lawyers there are. And finally, I talked to the Assistant Attorney General, who gives advice to the Oregon Health, Housing, Educational, and Cultural Facilities Authority, and she too agreed with the proposition that these funds can be used at religious property as long as the facility being constructed is not itself for religious or secular purposes. I then talked with Senator Harper, told him of the findings, and his comment was something to the effect, fine, I just wanted to be sure. Excuse me.
Okay. We are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
I would move House Bill 3207A to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 3207A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objections to the motion?
I'll object, Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran reported an objection. So ordered. Okay. Senator Starr, would you like to carry that now?
Carry that.
Okay. Okay. Close work session. Now do a public hearing on House Bill 3359.
Mr. Putnam.
Madam Chairman, the basis of this bill is to give protection to brokers and dealers who fire somebody because they were a crook. And this limits their liability for being honest in their reports to the regulator.
Do we have a sign-up sheet?
Our new clerk.
Thank you. Cindy Robert and Martin.
Yeah, that's me. Martin and Associates. Roger. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think Keith's description was quite good. But let me tell you this. My name is Cindy Robert. I represent D.A. Davidson Company. It's a regional brokerage firm that is headquartered in Montana but has offices in Portland and in Bend. This is a really simple bill. It's already passed in Idaho, Montana, and Washington, and it passed the House in Oregon unanimously. Let me explain to you what it does. Right now, if an employee of a brokerage house is fired, the employer fills out a U-5 form, and the U-5 form goes to the National Association of Security Dealers. It's a self-regulatory group that was put together by security dealers. That form is then made available to other brokerage firms should they be interested in hiring a broker, and it's also available to all of you should you be interested in choosing a broker to use for your activities. The problem is that we have found that a lot of times when a broker is let go, a lawyer intervenes and says, do not fill out that form disparagingly or we will sue you for defamation of character. So many of the firms, even though this seems implausible, don't want to have to fight against that. So they are simply putting things on the firing statement that really aren't quite true, such as not a good fit, downsizing, location change, things like this. Instead of filling out the form as it should be filled out to protect all of us and other brokerage houses from just recycling the same bad brokers. Currently, you see a lot of undermining of what the policy is supposed to be for, and this law encourages truthful and candid reporting of why a brokerage firm has hired fired a broker. We do have A3 amendments to it. I hope that you have those. They're a simple amendment. It includes in the definition after they're a broker-dealer, federally covered investment advisor, because as legislative counsel did the changes to the original bill, they put in state, not federally covered investment advisors. I will tell you that there was no opposition to this in the House, but in all honesty, I did do a gut and stuff, so you can't really expect people to show up there. However, I did make a point of going out to those who might be interested in finding out who opposed it in the other states and talking to them. There were no groups wanting to oppose this legislation. I will say that the Jim Harlan of the Department of Consumer Business Services, Division of Insurance and Corporate Securities, has helped me on this bill. He's been very helpful in making the language work for Oregon statute, and they are supportive of it as well. I believe he is here and could attest to that as well. Anyway, I'll answer any questions.
Mr. Hicks, thank you. What was the situation that brought the issue forward?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gourley, there's been a number of situations, and it has become actually, I'd like to be able to pinpoint where it started, and I can actually provide you with an article on several instances where this has occurred, where lawyers are actually using this as a means of suing for defamation of character. Because it's not actually a federal form per the federal government. This is a self a group that the securities dealers put together themselves to regulate the industry. I'd be happy to provide you with those stories, though. I have an article here.
I'd like to see it.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Did no one else sign up to testify? Is anyone else interested in testifying?
Well, we heard, Mr. Chair, that...
Mr. Harlan?
Yes.
Yeah. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
No questions other than, are you okay with the bill?
We're aware of the bill. We have,
yeah, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Harlan. I'm with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. As Ms. Robert testified, we have worked with her on this bill. We're aware of it, and we have no problems with it.
Okay. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3359, and we'll just hold that one for a day or two so you can get your information.
Right.
Okay.
Just asking Ms. Robert to get the information to Senator Gordon.
Okay. All right. We need to figure out what we haven't had a bit of a jump around so much. Okay, do work session on Senate Bill 334.
Oh, that's a fair bit. Are we moving this down?
Ms. Putnam.
Mr. Chairman, this bill was before the committee earlier. At that time, Mr. Van Atta, who proposed the bill, asked for an amendment that changed deleted the word or on page 2, line 9. In my request for counsel to remove that or, we received the information back that that was unnecessary and that the bill reads the way it should, and that the problem that Mr. Vannata was trying to solve actually does not exist, according to counsel.
Okay. You have no amendments then?
That is correct. Mr. Chairman, you're calling my attention to the fact that on line 30 is an improper citation. Counsel called sheepishly and said they've already fixed that. Apparently, a bill goes through that fixes glitches in the drafting of the law, and they've already taken care of that, according to counsel.
Interesting. Okay.
A typing error from 15 years back, as near as I can tell.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 334 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 334 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Decker?
Yes.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Senator Harper?
Senator
Starr?
Aye.
Chair Byers?
No. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 334 goes before with a due pass recommendation. Anyone like to carry it? Okay. Senator Gordley will carry. Okay, let's go to a public hearing on House Bill 2630, a public hearing.
Why don't you introduce this bill to us first? Okay.
2630. Mr. Chairman, 2630 is a bill out of House Representatives with no votes. And its purpose there was to allow public utilities to file balance sheets at the end of that utility's fiscal year. There are circumstances where PUC may also want them to file a calendar year report. Those provisions are left in the law. There are proposed numerous amendments to this. They are not ready. They are not done out of council. But if the chair wishes, I can tell you the essence of those amendments.
Why don't we let the gentleman in front of us tell us the amendments that they know them?
They do. They know
them. Chair Byer, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent Pacific Corp, an electric utility that operates in Oregon as Pacific Power. I want to just restate the original intent of 2630 and then talk about some of the proposed amendments that we'll be bringing to you on Wednesday, I believe. 2630 was originally a bill to simply allow utilities like PacifiCorp to file a balance sheet, which is our financial information, which is required from us as a regulatory entity in front of the Public Utility Commission on a fiscal year basis. Quite simply, the statute requires a calendar year basis. Our business operates on a fiscal year basis. We wanted to, and as you can see in the bill, subsection 2, it just says if a public utility maintains on a fiscal year basis that we can file our information on that particular fiscal year instead of a calendar year. Public Utility Commission signed off on the bill, passed unanimously on the House side. It's mainly just a technical. There was some we did add a line on the House side that the commission may require additional information from the you know, when you're on a calendar year basis and you switch from a fiscal year basis, there might be a little transition period. We added language that we will provide them any information they need for that transition. And that's the genesis of 2630. The amendments that we will be bringing to you on Wednesday were a negotiated agreement that we've been working on all session regarding a bill you heard probably about a month and a half ago on Senate Bill 598, which I'll, Steve Vinson will touch on, but I'll let you know that was the bill on the 3% deferred accounting system that that we were considering raising. And Senator Gordley was kind enough to be sitting on those negotiating sessions between the utilities, the electric and the gas utilities, and the customers to work out an agreement. And I'll say from the electric side, which is one of the main focuses of a negotiated agreement, we have come up with and conceptually, and that's what we want to make sure we get them right before we bring them to your committee, is the 3%, 0 to 3% deferred accounting will stay status quo. We have agreed to anything above 3% with a 6% cap, and this is electric utilities only. There would be a 6% cap on that. There is a new process and procedures for the customers to go through that process on the deferred accounting, and so they have agreed to allow us to be able to take that above 3% to 6% with more procedural protections for the customers written into that, and we will bring those to you and explain those in further detail at the next hearing. There'll also be a technical amendment on the cogeneration facility down in Klamath Falls. That is going into play as we speak, and the attorneys from the city of Klamath Falls, who I'll state Mark Nelson represents, brought this amendment to us just to clarify the relationship between entities like our power marketing side of our utility, which is the private side, it's not the public side of our company, and to allow cooperative arrangements between companies like ours and the city of Klamath Falls in that cogeneration facility. That'll be a small amendment, and we will explain that in further detail on Wednesday. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Steve Vinson with Vista Utilities. I guess I have nothing to say. He explained it all.
Including in the amendment the language of Senate Bill 942.
Senate Bill 942 is the issue with
City of Eugene.
Yeah, E-Web's amendments will be in the draft that Legislative Council is working on right now.
Okay, hold on a second. We will suspend, or we will temporarily suspend the hearing on House Bill 2960. We will open work.
We have come up with and conceptually, and that's what we want to make sure we get them right before we bring them to your committee, is the 3%, 0 to 3% deferred accounting will stay status quo. We have agreed to anything above 3% with a 6% cap, and this is electric utilities only. There would be a 6% cap on that. There is a new process and procedures for the customers to go through that process on the deferred accounting, and so they have agreed to allow us to be able to take that above 3% to 6% with more procedural protections for the customers written into that, and we will bring those to you and explain those in further detail at the next hearing. There will also be a technical amendment on the cogeneration facility down in Klamath Falls. That is going into play as we speak, and the attorneys from the city of Klamath Falls, who I'll state Mark Nelson represents, brought this amendment to us just to clarify the relationship between entities like our power marketing side of our utility, which is the private side, it's not the public side of our company, and to allow cooperative arrangements between companies like ours and the city of Klamath Falls in that cogeneration facility. That'll be a small amendment, and we will explain that in further detail on Wednesday. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Steve Vincent with Vista Utilities. I guess I have nothing to say. He explained it all.
Including in the amendment of language.
Senate Bill 942 is the issue with, EWEB amendments will be in the draft that legislative council is working on right now.
Hold on a second. We will suspend or suspend the hearing on House Bill 2950. We will open the work session on Senate Bill 439.
They should be prosecuted for abduction or custodial
negligence
or for kidnapping.
Mr. Chairman, earlier you had this bill that would have reduced the Workers' Compensation Board from five members down to three.
Provides a presumption that
and no further action was taken by the committee. We now have the Dash 3 amendment, which changed the membership from five to
termination
four.
Of parental rights.
And
if we included something like that in our law, would that
to you,
obviate the requirement of an investigation by FCF into the parents?
And, it shows a savings of $169,000 over the next biennium.
Because it's a strength of the presumption and what can be done to rebut the presumption, if anything. If it's an irrebuttable presumption, it's probably unconstitutional.
We have in our possession a letter signed by seven members of the MWAT committee that states that they support this bill with the Dash 3 amendment.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I don't know if the entire committee got that or not.
Jim Austin.
Okay. I did. Should have shared it with you. Okay. We have in front of us.
May I make a suggestion that you read the letter out loud for the record? It appears we don't all have it.
Certainly. Actually, the letter is addressed to Governor Kitzhoffer.
Chairman, it's members of the committee, I want to thank you for having a public hearing on this. And for the record, I am Jim Austin,
President of the Senate.
Kathy Lowe.
Dear Governor Kitzhoffer, as you may know, the Management Labor Advisory Committee, MLAC, heard Senate Bill 439 twice, once in its original form and then as amended to reduce the board to four members. Although MLAC voted against the bill on both occasions, after further consideration,
for a speech, I guess.
The below signed members have agreed to support the amended bill, which will eliminate one labor and one management position and add a public member. We believe this bill is in the best interest of the workers' compensation system. Thank you for your consideration. Sincerely, signed by Bob Shiprack, J.L. Wilson, who are the two chairs of MLAC, Michelle O'Rourke, Terry Sundstrom, Ken Allen, Diane Jansen, and Lisa Trussell.
As to the motive for these individuals, why they're doing it, we can always speculate, but clearly someone in a desperate place.
Mr. Chair, I'd move
to something like this. And this
Senator Atkinson moves the Dash 3 amendments in the Senate Bill 439. Is there discussion?
Environment, which is what we'd like.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, I don't think this is a big deal, but I'm not going to support it. I see that you gave us in the handout today an analysis of law changes creating spikes in board to do work laws. But I don't think it's a very fair analysis because Senate Bill 485 this time is actually designed to increase access to workers' comp system. And so I'm a little concerned that at the same time we're doing that, we're decreasing the number on the board. But again, you know, with MLAC signing on, it clearly is a lot better than the three-person construction to begin with. And I guess four is compromised between three and five, but I'm still probably going to be enough.
Okay. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you.
I am not familiar with this. With
the three-member board that we had previous, I think we had added members back in
1991, I was a married pregnant woman.
And actually, the three-member board turned out more work than the five-member board.
My son is doing very well, and I did not abandon him.
The workload has gone way down. If you talk to any of the members over, they will tell you that they don't have enough to do. Actually, I'd suggest the three-member board start with.
To read it, to understand.
But we changed that primarily because usually it takes the governor quite a while to appoint a new board member. And if you get down to two, it makes it very difficult to operate.
I also have these new items,
because that always makes sure there's always three members there.
A number of them have been mentioned.
That gives you labor management and public members.
Because I have not seen them, so they might very well have been covered.
Plus another covered member.
I think there should be a 30-day limit.
Four is really adequate to either workload. Ten before you five is not going to add nearly the number of cases that could be for the board.
This window allows the parents to reclaim their child.
So I think we find that the four-member board will actually still be surplus to the
abandonment or surrender of a child by a relative of the family, or in case where you have one child, one parent.
Senator Durfler probably knows more about this than I do. My understanding is this board is not.
And I think since medical technology has advanced, especially with DNA testing, I would say very well assured that the parent is coming forward to the actual parent.
So the administrator really operates, kind of runs the agency itself.
The other one I would suggest was the 30-day limit is that all rental rights are permanently terminated. This should automatically include any of the father's biological rights. Especially so that a father can come forward and say, I was not aware that the woman was pregnant, because the child should be at that time been placed for permanent adoption. I don't know if this is just a technicality, but I feel that one state agency should be in charge of this. It should be included in the advertisement so that any adopted parent can go ahead and properly register with this agency so that they'll be ready and willing to be able to take the children.
I don't believe this board meets to decide on these issues as a four-member board.
One thing was mentioned, what if parents or children want to find their parents when they were
adopted? Motion for amendment before.
I think DNA test would be a great way to start this off.
Amendment.
If it has it of record, and especially now that adoption records are open, this allows the parents to abandon their child this time. The record, whichever agency, adoption agency, would be able to locate the child. Especially if the child has requested it. These are just my personal opinions, and I hope you will consider them.
Aye.
Thank you.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 439 as amended by the committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
Well, when we talk about the parent, we talk about termination of parental rights. I mean, now, when you have a child born, you obviously have two parents. What happens to the other party? I mean, my assumption throughout the testimony is you have a woman who's the birth mother bringing the child in, and in essence abandoning the child, which would give rise to termination of parental rights. But what about the male half of the relationship?
I don't see the question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
move to the floor. Senator Durfler will carry the bill.
In a case where you would have a child that was abandoned by one.
We will now reopen our public hearing on House Bill 630.
Who that father is.
We're not done with these guys yet.
Mr. Chair, we thought the Senate President came to listen to us. Shouldn't do drugs in his closet.
Okay, I think, Steve, we were ready for your testimony.
I think he gave it.
I'll just say, Steve Vinson with Avista Utilities. I'll just say that the market volatility in electric and natural gas in the wholesale market, where our utilities buy natural gas or the electric utilities have to acquire electricity in the marketplace, that this bill, once we amend it, will reflect some changes in flexibility and rate-making authority by the PUC, give them the ability to address the volatility that each of the utilities is experiencing in the marketplace. I'll give you one real quick example. Avista Utilities operates in five states. We have electric distribution in Washington and Idaho. And of all of our load requirements, we only need to buy 10% on the market, or 100 megawatts short in our own system to serve our customers. And it's costing us $1 million a day. And that little 10% piece has become pretty expensive. So we have huge deferrals out there. Our cash flows are out of sight. And we have debt. And what, now obviously this bill doesn't address that, that's another state. But what this bill will do is it will allow in-state utilities to begin to work off that debt at a faster rate. That 3% cap in statute says you can only change your rates by 3% of your annual gross revenue. Well, if that applied to us in Washington, Idaho, I don't know, it could take us decades to work off the debt we've incurred just in the last 12 months. So that's why I believe that this bill is necessary. And the same applies to the natural gas utility in Oregon. Certainly not to that level of risk, but it is an important bill for the utilities. Thanks.
Thank you.
It raises some questions because
the public hearing, we'll bring the bill back on Wednesday. Hopefully we'll have an amendment at that time. Are we ready to go? I think we've gotten through our entire agenda.
Okay.
That's up to that.
Well,
that process that we're currently
I've been asked to do market calendars for May 31, 5:30 or 6, something like that, for an event in Baker, Oregon. And I'll get more information to your staff. This is a request from the members of this committee.
Where's Dayton? You don't know where Dayton is?
You don't know where Dayton is?
It's in his district.
I know where Tigris
is. Southwest of
Tigris. Is it where I think?
Yeah.
It's in my district. Senator Gorley, do you know what place that this might be at? Do you know the famous place? Have you ever eaten at the Palmer House?
I've heard of it, but I've not been there.
Let me tell you numbers from someone who lives 300 miles away. If this were to happen to Palmer House, it is one of the finest dinners you'll get. Specializes in the definition.
But that definition is in the bill now.
Actually,
does not include medical
offices, which the mayor of that particular restaurant worked with Chris on the
in Salem. Kaiser has two examples.
Yes, the Joel Palmer House will be the site of our
one in North Lancaster. Those are not hospitals.
Okay, and that is the 31st
of this hospital. They're not open 24 hours.
Okay, thank you, committee members, for a job well done today. We got through about 15 bills in only an hour and 15 minutes.
They are large
adjourned.
And they would not be encompassed within this bill and within the immunities that would be provided by this bill for an abandonment. The issue is, I think, really a policy one for the committee of what breadth of qualified facilities do you want to define in the bill? Should it be narrow, limited to hospitals or a subset of hospitals, or should it be a broad array of facilities? Medical or otherwise, and that really is a policy issue, but we wanted to bring to your attention that at least the way the bill is drafted now, it doesn't encompass some large medical operations in the state. We would also suggest that you consider broadening the immunity for any health care provider or physician or other good Samaritan who takes a step to intervene in these kinds of circumstances. As the bill is drafted now, the immunity under the bill only applies in one of these authorized facilities for certain personnel in those facilities. And again, we understand the purpose of the bill to encourage good Samaritans to step forward, and would request that you look at specifically whether broader immunity ought to be provided in that circumstance.
testify.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Bruce, do you know if we have a definition statute of, what is it, medical facility?
There is not.
There is not. We do have a criminal statute, eh?
Okay.
There's a reference there.
I'm not aware of that.
Okay, I think your suggestion's good. The Good Samaritan statute exists, and I'm going to be wanting to couple this to that. So, any other questions, comments, statements? All right, thank you, Mr. Bishop. Appreciate it. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 199?
Good Samaritan.
Any official comments from the committee?
Yeah, I do. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and all the members of this committee, because you know, we ordinarily would not meet at this time, and you're willing to do that, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate that. And I know Senator Metzger's been running between two committees, and Senator Vern Duncan had to run over the committee, and he wanted to be here. And so, and I know that Roger, others, you may have had appointments you've had to cancel, so I really appreciate your willingness to do this. I want to thank all the witnesses, many of whom have come some distance to testify on this issue, so I really appreciate that very much. I think it's been a very good hearing on this issue, and hope the committee feels that we've gotten a pretty good feeling for the issues involved and concerns, and I hope that the bill itself and the amendments have, gone a long way to try to really reach out to the different concerns and issues here, Mr. Chair, even though I know that I can tell by being around you, you want some more work done on the piece of legislation. I do hope in the end, though, that we'll be willing to move it forward, thank you very much.
I think the hearing is productive in the sense that there were a number of issues that were raised, and so I will defer to the Vice Chair when you feel that there are amendments that satisfy the concerns raised and that you've got the support of the committee. We'll bring it back for work session. Okay. With that, we're adjourned.